While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On the Reading News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and I'm here to keep you company from now up until 14:30. Now, On the Reading News Analysis, as your trusted source for the latest news, developments and insights from Namibia and around the world, we go beyond the headlines to examine the issues shaping our societies, our economies and the future, from governance and public policy to business, technology, health and climate change and international affairs. We provide the context and analysis needed to understand the stories that do matter most. Now, this afternoon, we focus on key developments and conversations shaping public discourse across Namibia and beyond. Among the issues on our radar, efforts to strengthen governance, transparency and accountability in the public sector, developments in the economy and business environment, regional political and economic affairs, and the global trends influencing decision making at home and abroad. As Namibia continues to navigate opportunities and challenges in a rapidly changing world, informed discussion remains essential. Through thorough, careful analysis and balanced reporting, we examine not only what is happening, but also the implications for citizens, institutions, businesses, and communities. Now, right here on the Reading News, we believe informed citizens build stronger communities. That is why we remain committed to delivering credible journalism, balanced reporting, and thoughtful analysis that empowers you to engage with the issues affecting your daily life and the future of our nation. Now, through comprehensive coverage, expert insights, exclusive interviews and real-time updates, we connect the dots behind today's major developments and emerging trends. Whether it is policy shifts and economic development, a technological innovation, or an international event with local implications, our goal remains the same. That is to keep you informed, engaged, and ahead of the conversation. So stay connected with us across our broadcasting and digital platforms for the latest updates throughout the day. Also join the discussion and share your views and be part of the growing community that values informed dialogue and credible news. Because this right here is On the Reading News Analysis, delivering the facts, examining the impact, and helping you make sense of the stories shaping Namibia, Africa, and the world. Let's get right into these news discussions. The Government Institution Pension Fund, GIPF, says it has grown its total assets valued at 221.1 billion Namibian dollars in its 2026 up from 153 billion in 2023, reflecting significant growth over the past 3 years. Now, speaking during the launch of the GIPF 2026-2029 strategic plan, Petrus Nevonga, chairperson of the GIPF Investment Committee, said the fund continues to play a critical role in supporting Namibia's socio-economic development through strategic investment in education, healthcare, businesses, and the developmental infrastructure. Nevonga noted that the pension fund maintains a diversified investment portfolio, spanning several asset classes, including listed equities, private credit, property, private equity, and other investment vehicles. He further highlighted the GIPF's commitment to domestic investment, revealing that 48% of GIPF's total investments are allocated within Namibia, contributing to local economic growth, job creation, and infrastructure development. The figures were presented as part of the fund's new strategic plan, which outlines GIPF's priorities and vision for 2026 to 2029 period. Let's now hear from Petrus Nevonga. that is chairperson for GIPS Investment Fund.
It was established in 1989, created on the eve of independence to secure the pension of Namibia civil servant and the public institutions. Thank you. At 1996, the fund value was 4.4 billion, and that is that was the early asset base built through compulsory member contributions and the prudent stewardship. We then have our investment shift, our investment direction strategy, which was set in the year 2008 to 2010. Which was a more robust investment approach emerged, aligning asset to liabilities, introducing a specialist mandate, and expanding into unlisted investment to support the long-term member value and the local economic development. As a result of this investment direction strategy, today, we are reporting a fully funded defined benefit fund serving 151,000 members and beneficiaries at the value of 221.1 billion as at May 2026. Our promises, we do not chase the market. We fund liabilities. As a defined fund, our investment strategy is built backward from cash flows we owe members for decades to come. We guard, protect our promise. A defined benefit fund where members' pensions are granted regardless of the market behavior, because this is a defined benefit fund. This fund is fully funded, and I think it's one of the few funds in Africa with a current funding level of 119%, and it can cover all the obligations. The industry target, I think, is at around 100, the fund to be funded at 100%. Our set funding level as a GIPF is 105. Our actual performance in terms of the funding level is 119. Now, the difference above the market target, we are above 19%, and in terms of our funding level, we are about a funding level target, we are about 14% above our target. And this we were able to achieve through our investment managers and professionals. And therefore, I want to agree that this is indeed the event. Asset matched to long-dated liability through liability-driven investing. Very disciplined on risk, liquidity, regulatory compliance at all times. We grow real value. That's the value we earn, less cost, and we deliver return of CPI. We set our target to deliver a return of CPI plus 5 per annum over the long term to preserve members.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything IMBA has to offer at an unbeatable price. IMBA, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Annum, over the long term to preserve members' buying power. Diversify globally while anchoring 47% of the fund in Namibia, in Namibian asset. If you look at the fund value, as we have indicated, at 221.1 billion, and investing 47% in Namibia, it means about 100 billion of our asset is invested in Namibia. Catalyze national development through impactful unlisted investment, creating a better future for our members and for the economy. Our members and the economy they retire into. In terms of our previous strategic plan to current, I want to speak to you on first on this 1, 2, 3, 4. Our last strategic plan was launched 2023, and it ended 2026. Now, at the time, the fund value was 153 billion. At the end of the strategic plan, the fund value is 221.1 billion. What does it mean? It means for the 3 years strategic plan, which ended this year, the fund has earned about, created a value in addition to 153 of about 68.1 billion. And it represents an average per annum of about 22.7 billion. Now, if you take the 68.1 over the departure point of 153, you realize that the performance of the fund from this to here, it has performed with about 44.5%. And it translating in about 15% per annum. Before I speak to this one, I want us to look at this one. As at April 2025, our fund value was 184 billion. 12 months down the line to May 2026, the fund value has increased, has grown from 184 to 221. That represents a 16.1 return over that 1 year. And if you remember that I said our performance target is CPI plus 5, we have performed 9% above our CPI plus 5 target. We have committed 12.5% of our fund asset of this value in our unlisted investment, amounting to 26.2 billion. And of course, I have informed you the members, the number of members that we are serving. Our footprint in terms of our investment deployment, we have invested in Africa, South Africa, China, international, emerging market, and Africa. And you realize that the big chunk, about 48%, is invested in Namibia, followed by international and other follows. We invests in different asset class. As you can see here, we invest in listed instrument, collective investment scheme, private credit, cash and other. We invest in bill, bond and securities, private equity and infrastructure, as well as property. You will see that most of our investment, about 43%, is invested in listed equity, followed by the bills, bond, and the security at 29, and other follows. Our investment to date and the commitment has revealed that has contributed to national development. Member saving, build as homes, job, clean energy, and enterprises. Over 6.5 billion put to work across the real economy in every region. Our contribution to national growth through economic growth, transformation, and resilience, we have about 100 billion, that's what I mentioned, about 43% invested in Namibian assets, amounting to our exposure to Namibia is about 47.700 billion. A local mandate, investment platforms, 44, and local commitment to unlisted investment and project, 11.1 billion. We have about 29 fund managers, Namibian market builders. When we started our investment activities, that time when people were fond of speaking Afrikaans investment professional, when they come in from what they call Wolf Kantoor, at that side of the Orange River. Now, we refuse to remain at that, and therefore we ensured building Namibian market through our own Namibian investment professionals, and majority of them are here, and we appreciate what they are doing. In terms of business-backed portfolio company, 314, and our footprint, as per our geographical location, Namibia, we have 14 regions. Our footprint is across all the region. In terms of our SDG, we have advanced with 9 out of 17. And of course, to their description, you can see what are those. And again, with regard to human development and community resilience, GRPF-backed capital has helped to build homes, service land, hospitals, jobs, and the skill. Social infrastructure that support a resilient workforce. Through this, we have delivered about 7,840 houses since the inception, since 2016. And we have invested around 154 billion in education, Comrade Kavali. Something here in education. And of course, we have serviced about 5,884 plots, healthcare services, 100 million, and job supported, 10,000. In the year 2025, Housing and Infrastructure Fund, job created, 4,052. In the student accommodation, we have invested about 400 million. And in hospital, we have invested in a hospital that delivers about 285 beds. With regard to environment,
also speaking at the event yesterday is one of the board members who happens to be the Deputy Minister of Health and Social Services, that is Penda Ithindi.
Gave it to me so that I don't get in trouble also. Into the country's national in 2027. The GIPF and its investment partners are positioning themselves. At crossroads, be your guide with real GDP growth in advanced economies being projected to improve in 2026. At 80 programs and 243 sub-programs. To implement these projects by 2030, we need 506.7 billion. This is not small change. This budget, therefore, needs all of us. Director of Proceedings, according to the Bank of Namibia's economic outlook for the period March 2026, global economic growth is projected to remain steady over the 2026-2027 period, with real GDP growth in advanced economies being projected to improve in 2026, with a subsequent marginal deceleration in 2027. This provides an opportunity for entities such as the GIPF and its investment managers to provide value to the civil servants of Namibia through the fund's investment strategies that are anchored on being catalysts for national development to provide impact for the communities in which GIPF members reside and work. Looking ahead, Namibia's macroeconomic position presents opportunities for growth. There are major shifts and advances in the oil and gas, green hydrogen, and mining sectors in the country, providing further prospects for supporting broader national development through focused and responsible investment in these sectors. I strongly believe that the GIPF and its investment partners are positioning themselves positively to consider investments in these sectors. This will meaningfully and with impact support GIPF's mandate whilst driving socioeconomic development in Namibia. The launch, and most importantly, the successful implementation of the GIPF strategic plan for the period 2026-2029 brings hope to GIPF members, the government, and rural communities across the country who anticipate hope for a brighter tomorrow. I am delighted to observe that the GIPF 5-3-year strategy is aligned to the country's development agendas, such as Vision 2030, NDP 6, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, to create societal value through stimulating economic activity, reducing poverty, promoting social development, and supporting regional equity. GIPF should continue to contribute to Namibia's development goals by investing in sectors that support national priorities and long-term socioeconomic growth. As a responsible institutional investor, GIPF must work closely with its asset managers to allocate capital to sustainable development initiatives that generate measurable social and environmental outcomes. These investments contribute significantly to national development while preserving and growing value for its members. Director of Ceremonies, I am reliably informed that during the past 5 years, GIPF's impact was directed towards initiatives in food security, renewable energy, healthcare, housing, education, and employment creation. During the same period, the GIPF paid benefits in excess of 30 billion due to its members, whilst committing 2.7 billion in renewable energy and 17.2 billion in national infrastructure projects. Furthermore, the fund constructed over 80,000 houses and serviced land for over 5,000 plots and created 10,000 jobs. These are good initiatives. Please do more. Looking forward, I take great comfort in learning that the GIPF intends to make further impactful local investments that will result in real, measurable economic growth impact, transformation, and shall continue to contribute to localization of manufacturing capacity. That would look to substitute importation of goods, focus on investments in local security, in local food security.
Okay, we heard it from GIPF side. Let's now pause here shortly and we'll be back. Don't go anyway.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk. That's why I'm
Welcome back, and now talking about navigating the entrepreneurship landscape as a woman, let's take a listen to Jenny Ann Campbell, award-winning entrepreneur.
Thank you very much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Thanks so much for having me. Great. In cold South Africa today.
Yes. Bit chilly here in Namibia as well. But let's get right into it. If you can, please share your career, Jenny, and how you got to where you are today.
So I started my career 24 years ago in the event space. I was a graphic designer by trade, and I remember going for my first interview really excited, and I saw about 5 computers in the studio, so I thought I was going to be joining this huge studio. And then day one of me starting my job, it turned out I was the only designer in that studio. So, you know, I panicked at the time, but in hindsight, it was the most incredible thing to get thrown into the deep end, because it was a case of sink or swim. I used to look back in old invoice books that had that carbon paper to see how to contact a printer and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And I really had no one to compare myself to, which I have learned throughout my career is a superpower, because you then set your own goals and try better yourself every time. I then moved from there into the advertising world. Mm-hmm. And you thoroughly enjoyed that space. South Africa then went through a recession, and my boss at the time said to me, in order for me to get the salary that I needed, he'd be comfortable if I did some freelance work. So I freelanced and worked, and slowly my freelance work started, you know, kind of overtaking my capacity. So I went on my own. And when I went on my own, I started renting space with my husband's company at the time. Mm-hmm. And we shared office space. And what I noticed was happening is that every time a supplier came in or a client, they would immediately go to my husband's office. And I just couldn't understand this narrative, because we had two beautiful businesses in their own right. And I started seeing this perception of women in business, age and women. I used to even pay a male friend of mine to come to meetings with me, because I would find that the buy-in would be so much greater with him sitting in the room. He wouldn't really even contribute to the conversation, but him being there. And this really infuriated me, to be honest. So I sat in a space going, how can I actively change this in a beautifully positive way? Yeah. And I set out to build an all-female agency. And that is what I did. And 15 years later, a beautifully strong all-female agency that I sold last year to two women in the business who worked their way up and did incredibly well and bought it through a management buyout. So it's a beautiful success story of, you know, doing the grind and the success at the end of it.
That's fantastic to hear. I mean, you identified a problem and provided a fantastic solution. So speaking now of the solution, can you tell us a little bit about your experience at JAW, and, you know, if you can dive into what does this entity seek to provide to the market?
100%. So JAW is the agency that I built, and it was one of the greatest privileges of my life. It's an agency that runs from today, servicing clients globally, through the line marketing campaigns. So anything coming up with strategies for a client could be internalizations, could be through the line, right down to the very last implementation. Mm-hmm. And it's a female complement, but we do have amazing partnerships that have been built over the last very many years. And I think that is what has made the business shine so strongly in how it treats its suppliers and the relationships that we have pride in those partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm most proud of in the business is the culture. So much so that I ended up writing a book based on my experiences in JAW, mm-hmm. because I saw how treating people with kindness and empathy, it's good business that results in good business, because by doing good, it's actually good for your bottom line as well. And we had a culture at JAW where if you needed to take your kids to the doctor, it's not this sort of feeling that you have to be apologetic for life that was around in my generation. You know, it's an era of accountability and responsibility and not clock watching, where you're not a seat warmer. It's based on your deliverables, not on your hours. And I think it's a very necessary way to think in today's climate. So I'd say that's one of my biggest pride points from JAW.
100%. That's fantastic to hear. And in your experience now with you know, creating this entity to support female entrepreneurs, what are some common challenges you have noticed that female entrepreneurs face in the industry?
Many. I don't know. Have you seen that the movie that's on at the moment called Ladies First with Sacha Baron Cohen?
Yes, yes.
It's an absolutely comical take on a very, very real problem. Mm-hmm. And I urge anyone to just watch that movie, have a laugh. But to see what females actually deal with in business, I feel because of all of that, there's a confidence issue, not a capability issue. Mm-hmm. Men are taught that they, you know, you can start before you feel ready, because they've got that inherent confidence, where women frequently wait too long to start because they overthink everything and they don't have that confidence. So my advocacy would be, say, come on, you know, get in there, get started, because you have the capability. And I believe that women have such an invisible burden where they, you know, working in business, you're managing households, children, caregiving responsibilities and community expectations, that there's so much more to carry that you often have this weight that is not seen by your employers.
Yeah.
And there's so much more that you have to balance. And the minute you allow women to handle all of it with equal weight when the time arises, you get the best out of those employees. Instead of seeing it as a challenge, you know, that females take maternity leave and those sorts of situations. Running an all-female business, of course those are challenges that come up. But those are things that make women have superpowers in business, that nurturing side, that mm-hmm. empathetic side, that ability to run a household and juggle a gazillion balls is an absolute superpower in business.
100%. And Jenny, you said you've been in business for around 2 decades now, and some of these challenges and stereotypes you've been mentioning, do you think any of these have changed or improved over the years?
They've definitely improved over the years. I would be remiss to say that they haven't, but I still think that there's a lot of a learning to happen. Mm-hmm. I see it in my own family thinking. I see it in my community. I see it in my own business, in my experiences with clients and how we adult with. There's still a lot of previous learnings that we have to unlearn in order for things to change for the next generation.
100%. But it's good to hear that some progress is at least being made.
Definitely is.
So back to Jo, can you share one of your favorite success stories from a female entrepreneur or colleague that you've helped over the years?
So while I was going through the process of selling Jo and after Jo, I've built a platform called The Good Businesswoman. Mm-hmm. And what that platform does is it helps people in any business space understand how, like I said, doing good can be good for business, how to lead to create a great team. And I wrote a book called Feeding Unicorns. And if I were to talk about a success story, it would be based on that, because I wrote that book using my lived experience. I didn't start out, I spoke about how I started out as a graphic designer. I didn't start out as a business mind, you know, who wrote this book. I've written the book based on my lived experience of the challenges in going from a freelancer to a business owner, in growing organically into your role. And in Africa, you know, we have so many people who follow that same journey that I have. Yeah. So I wrote this book, Feeding Unicorns, and I've always asked people for their feedback. And one lady contacted me and she said she's the head of finance at a massive company in South Africa. And she read two books. She read Lead In by Sheryl Sandberg and she read Feeding Unicorns by me, mm-hmm. Jenny Campbell. And she said that what she got from Lead In was the confidence to go for what you want and to believe that you can make it happen and to kind of push forward while you're learning. And what she got from Feeding Unicorns was how to treat her team and how to use empathy as your superpower and kindness and think about all the different aspects of your employees, their personalities, whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, they love languages, how to harness that and lead. And within 4 months of her reading the book and implementing the strategies that I'd set out, she said that it was absolutely phenomenal, the changes that they started seeing. Staff turnover in her department over that next year was the lowest in the entire business. Mm-hmm. The mood has changed to the point that it changed leveling up, not just the people she managed, but it changed to her CFO.
Yeah.
Where the leaders above her wanted to start emulating her behavior. Mm-hmm. So there was this ripple effect from her actions that was no longer leading down, but leading up.
Yeah.
And that's incredible to see actual change happening. And that's what it was, a beautiful pride point for me, because there were very actionable steps in the book. And she took the time to send me a message going, I need to thank you because I took this to heart. I've implemented, I've made it highlights and sticky notes, and I've got your book next to me at my desk and I love it. And since then she's ordered a bunch of copies for everyone in the leadership role in her business because she believes in it so much. So I would have to say that's my favorite success story.
No, that's fantastic, and it's a testament to, you know, they say positivity is contagious.
100%.
And on the continent, the importance of the SME sector is well known. But I want to hear from you, if you can, go into detail about how important it is for women in particular to be involved in the SME sector.
Definitely. It's absolutely critical. You know, women make up around 58% of Africa's self-employed population, mm-hmm. and contribute approximately 13% of the continent's GDP. You know, I was doing some research the other day and it shows that women reinvest up to 90% of their income back into their families and communities.
Oh, wow.
It could be through education, health, nutrition. So, you know, if you think about it very simply, when you support a female entrepreneur, the impact rarely stops with them. It's going to be impacting families, communities, education, health, nutrition, far beyond. If they are reinvesting 90%, imagine the impact.
Exactly.
So 100% we should be driving the force to support female entrepreneurs in Africa.
100%. And for any women listening, particularly young women that are listening to this right now, who have thoughts about joining the sector, what words of advice would you give to them?
Start. You might not feel ready.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk about aptitude and attitude. And aptitude is, do you have the right brain for the job? Not do you have the right skill. Skill can be learned. If you have internet access and you can learn from YouTube and you can, you know, skill can be learned, but aptitude, do you have the right thinking and do you have the right attitude? If you have a positive attitude, you're willing to put in the hard work and learn. That means you are ready, the aptitude and the attitude, and you go for it. You can't wait until you know everything, because you'll never be able to start, because you'll never know everything.
Okay.
So just be curious. Ask questions, find people who know more than you do, and learn as quickly as you can and stay humble.
Exactly, exactly. And my last question for you, now speaking of finding people who know more than you, how important is it for an upcoming female entrepreneur to have a female mentor that they can learn from?
I think mentors are incredibly valuable, but I wouldn't say that they have to be female.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, I built a female agency and I really wanted to empower women in the industry, but I'm definitely, that doesn't mean I'm anything anti-men.
Mm-hmm.
And they're incredible male entrepreneurs that you can learn so much from. So I believe finding a mentor is incredibly valuable just as that. But I think what matters most is, above a mentor, is also finding people who genuinely want to see you succeed and are willing to tell you the truth and help you get there. You know, having someone tell you what you should do versus networking and starting to find people who can help open doors for you, it's a very different thing.
Yeah.
And when you get into a space where you have met people who will openly mention your name in a room that you're not in, and say, you know what, I know a person who'd be great for this role. And they contact you and they, you know, network, expand your community, your business community, so that you are mentioning other people's names and helping them and they are helping you. Because there's enough work for everyone if we are open to sharing. And I find that because in the entrepreneurial space, it's so terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
You start feeling selfish with any, you know, contacts that you have.
Yeah.
But when I say there's enough work, I know it's an extremely challenging work climate, but for entrepreneurs, there's enough if you are going out there and finding it, making the work. So building a community where people want to mention your names, that is where you're going to win. And you do the same for them. So, you know, use LinkedIn, go to events, and build your network. That is going to be an absolute driver.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself. Ms. Jenny, thank you very much for your time today, and wish you all the best in your future endeavors, and hopefully you can stay warm in the chilly Cape Town.
Thank you so much. It was great chatting to you today. Keep well.
Thank you as well.
Bye.
Okay, and there you had it from Jenny Ann Campbell, award-winning entrepreneur. I think you can tell from the way she shares enthusiastically and passionately about women in entrepreneur, or women navigating the entrepreneurship landscape. And the conversation was facilitated by my colleague, H.D. Walenga. Nonetheless, let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We will be back shortly. Do stay tuned for more News Economic Indicators comes your way very soon. And thereafter, news beyond the borders of Namibia. You wouldn't want to miss that. Also, get ready to chip in and air your contributions and opinions. Perhaps ask questions on 083-288-401. That's the number in studio, 083-288-401. I'll see you soon.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the
eye. Thanks so much for having me. Great. Cold South Africa today.
Okay, and now for economic indicators before we go for news beyond the borders of Namibia. US dollar today is equals to 16 Namibian dollars point 51 cents, and £1 sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars point 06 cents. €1 is equals to 19 Namibian dollars point 05 cents. $1 Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars point 55 cents. $1 United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars point 50 cents. $1 Chinese yuan is equals to 2 Namibian dollars point 44 cents. And $1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 22 cents. That being said, let's now cross over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off with renewable energy, where Eskom in South Africa launches company to supply green energy. And I think that's quite interesting news coming from a non-renewable energy already.
Power utility, yes.
Launching renewable energy or taking part in renewable energy.
Eskom has launched Eskom Green, a renewable energy division aimed at accelerating the development of large-scale renewable energy projects. The initiative also aims to assist large industrial users in meeting their decarbonization and energy transition goals. For more on this, rejoined by Eskom Group Executive for Renewables, Rivoningo Mnisi. Rivoningo, good evening. Thank you so much for this. I'm glad you're taking that in such good stride. I do have to ask, why does Eskom have any interest in participating as a player in the renewable space?
No, thank you, and good evening to the viewers. I think, just like any other utility, renewables is the technology that is available. What we've been doing in the past couple of months, we've been benchmarking utilities across the globe. And what we've noticed is that all the best utilities, to set themselves up for the future and for sustainability, actually started a subsidiary that strictly focused on the world. And it is for this reason that we respect it, and we believe that of Eskom in the sustainability of South Africa.
Yeah. We know that renewable projects are incredibly capital intensive. You don't have a balance sheet of your own just yet. You'll certainly be relying on the balance sheet of Eskom, which is still very much, despite the debt forgiveness program or the debt restructuring program that it went through a couple of years ago, is still highly indebted as an organization, as an institution. One, how will you be raising capital to be able to undertake these large-scale, very intensive, capital-intensive projects? And secondly, how long will it then take the organization to build up a balance sheet that is able to compete, you know, toe for toe against some of the big players already in the space that have already had a head start in this?
Well, thank you. I think there's a myth around financing, especially when it comes to renewables. And like I said, when we did our benchmark exercise globally and also locally, what we picked up is that almost 100% of renewables are funded through project finance structures. These are SPVs, special purpose vehicles, which can take any sort of innovation to raise funding that do not necessarily rest on the balance sheet of the main organization. So we are also taking an innovative approach in terms of how we raise funding, and we are implementing special purpose vehicles to fund our project, and we will be crowding financiers across the globe to participate with us in terms of these SPVs.
Yeah, grid access is going to be a big problem, right? There are a number of renewable energy players in the space right now with projects ready to go, but they do not have grid access and connectivity because there's limited grid space. Now, the Minister of Electricity and Energy had promised a massive undertaking over the next 13 years to effectively expand or double the grid capacity that South Africa currently has, particularly in the Lowveld, where a great deal of grid connectivity and transmission lines are needed, desperately so, especially if we look at Northern Cape and we want to be able to connect those solar projects that's taking place in the Northern Cape. How do you then plan to be able to get the right sort of project financing going, de-risk it, if you can't guarantee your financiers that you'll be able to go live?
I think there's one thing that is often misunderstood in the market when it comes to Eskom. Eskom is one of the biggest landlords in the country. And secondly, our power stations owns a lot of land in close proximity to the grid and infrastructure. And all of these things, Eskom actually owns and has great expertise in terms of implementing utility scale kind of projects. So all of these things are actually advantages that we have. And if you follow, in particular, our strategy, we have been very clear that our just energy transition strategy will decouple decommissioning of power stations with the just energy transition journey. What it means is simply that we will be looking at opportunities next to our power stations where there's grid, where there's infrastructure, and we'll be implementing projects close to those that will be able to connect much quicker. Not only will it be able to connect much quicker, it will be cheaper and it will be easy to scale within the next 5 years.
Yeah. And I guess the important question here is, and you would have had to make a promise to your shareholder, the minister in this instance, or Eskom more directly, what will be your capacity connected to the grid, let's say 10 years from now?
I think we're starting with going to the market on a hybrid solution in 2026. We're finalizing that. We should be out in the market probably anytime after this coming month, where we're taking out 2 gig of a hybrid solution, which means PV and BESS, and also the pump storage of about 1.5 gigawatts. That's almost 3.5 gigawatts to 4 gigs that we'll be taking out to the market. In 2030, we definitely positioned to deliver 5.6, which will be a combination of all the renewable technologies, including wind. In 2035, we'll be delivering about 21 gigawatts, and in 2040, 32 gigawatts. One needs to also reflect on this in terms of what does it mean for a normal South African. South Africa has been on the journey for the past 10 years in terms of renewables, but we've got little to show when it comes to industrialization or creating clean jobs, never mind the factories to manufacture all these components that we use within the renewables. So this opportunity for Eskom to build on 32 gigs by 2040 also presents an industrialization and an economic growth opportunity for South Africa.
32 gigawatts is just about the current demand that South Africa has. So you're effectively going to build enough capacity to meet South Africa's current demand.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Efilo Shisho, Otaliku Landula, Konave, Wayuk. ekwashilipalekolo maruendo paiwano kupitila mo NHB watukwateleko mesho ekwashilipalekolo afika mafio pedola emiliona omlongo da Namibia moshilio shetukeshe kuyanja omakwafo unamiti enashane filo shisholo paulumo mumbu kwa aboveli ponjeo shilongo shijo shitopo rwasho ijo yetu tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash opo umone ya kulolo polis mwule o minute disyonailela lishangifako nhp.com.na omanga ino ya moruendo ponjeo shilongo emangono malandula pano ododino kulandurwa NHP rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
As rightly reported there, Eskom officially launched Eskom Green on Tuesday, the 9th of June 2026. And it's a dedicated renewable energy business inside Eskom, another division within Eskom, focused on utility scale solar, wind, hydro, and battery storage. Hydro, that electricity from water. It will later become a wholly owned subsidiary with its own board. Now, South Africa still gets 90% of power from Eskom's coal fleet, but coal plants are aging with availability below 50%, and Eskom Green targets 32 gigawatts of renewable energy by 2040, as he rightly stated there, and 6 gigawatts of renewable or 6 gigawatts of carbon-free power by 2030. That new capacity is needed because the 2025 shows a generation gap. Only 50% of awarded renewable projects since 2019 were actually built. And Eskom says this division will, quotes unquote, rapidly accelerate options to keep the lights on. So it's a good thing that they're exploring another aspect. I mean, renewable energy is now the new thing. And although many people who obviously might not understand what's going on and the behind the scenes of it, but those who actually take time to understand it will then come on board to embrace it. But it will need obviously thorough understanding as well. Now, in terms of decarbonization, Eskom still supplies most of Africa's biggest economy from coal, and Eskom Green is designed to help mining and manufacturing customers cut carbon footprint and stay competitive as global buyers impose carbon border taxes. Not simply about carbon compliance, but delivering leading edge solutions at scale for customers' decarbonization. And Electricity Minister Marco Opa says the South African government is pining hopes on renewables to drastically cut South Africa's high electricity costs. And Eskom Green is said to will use Eskom's existing land, grid access and infrastructure at decommissioning coal stations and also repurposing coal sites in order to avoid wasted assets and support jobs and community transition. Now, the unit was created after a benchmark of 20 plus units renewables needed, with agile decision making, diverse capital and partnership models that are different from Eskom's old vertically integrated model. And it's said to work with private developers, not to crowd them out. And it is a shift. Eskom Green is a shift from coal only to a blended energy mix comprising both of renewable and non-renewable energy. Okay, now in other news, agriculture. South Africa and Italy strengthen trade ties.
South Africa and Italy have strengthened their agricultural trade relations following the final approval of a technical agreement that will pave the way for the export of Italian table grapes to South African markets. For more on this, we're joined by a senior economist for trade research at the National Agricultural Marketing Council, Thabile Nkunjana. Thabile, good evening. Thank you so much for your time this evening. Really do appreciate it. South Africa exports a considerable amount of wine to Italy, and South Africa imports a considerable amount of wine from Italy. And that is because the grape varietals that the two countries have are seemingly sort of unique to each other that the other doesn't have. And so there seems to be some level of synergy there. But what are the other potential and for synergies between South Africa and Italy from an agricultural trade perspective?
Good evening to you, Oliver, and the SABC viewers. Yeah, so you are mentioning one product, which is wine, that South Africa and Italy do trade. But I can tell you that there's a number of those products that the two countries trade with one another, including the likes of the chocolates, pasta, coffee, and a lot of other value addition products that Italy sells to the world. And in fact, that is actually part of the reasons that South Africa is deepening its trade with Italy, because you'll recall even from since the NDP and to our master plan, one of the key drivers of South Africa has been to value addition to our products. And with Italy being a developed country that is doing so well with that, this forum has been seen as a driver to that. And South Africa has been engaging Italy for some time now through the CREA, an institution from Italy's state, and of course working with South African institutions. So this is a deeper integration between these two countries. And of course, there is so much that, already we're trading within the two countries, with South Africa's exports to the Italian market last year amounting to about 2.5 billion. But Italy is still benefiting because its exports to the South African market is still around 3.2 billion, which is a little bit more than North Africa. So therefore, there is so much that the two countries can do.
Yeah. Italy is a population size comparable to that of South Africa. They're sitting at around 60 million at the moment. We're sitting at about 62 million. So the sizes of the markets are relatively similar. But of course, Italy has far greater purchasing power, given that it finds itself in the Eurozone, which is an important part as a trading ecosystem. Does it give us access to those secondary markets?
Certainly, Oliver, because for one, as I mentioned to you, that South Africa is on a drive to, process or a value add, to its primary production. We are doing so well in terms of our primary production. We're within the top 15 of the countries that are exporting fruits into the world, top 40 in the world that are exporting agricultural products, and the only country from Africa that is within that range. So, relatively, we are doing so well in terms of primary production, and with the drive to a value add to that, countries like Italy, as it is the case for the whole European Union, South Africa is targeting that. And with South Africa being such a good and a trading altar, partner with the Italians, and of course with, the European Union itself, we are seeing this as an opportunity, because as this thing stands now, Italy is the sixth largest trading partner with South Africa. So therefore, it is one of the important markets, not only for the agricultural sector, but even the other sectors across, the country and the economy.
So what does this technical agreement look like, and what barriers does it remove? There's a special situation which a few years ago, this seemed to have been a trade anomaly. South Africa had at the time removed tariffs on nuts, particularly cashews and macadamia nuts, but had tariffs on peanut butter, which in many instances was made 100% of the nuts. It's the same thing, just in different forms, but the one has a tariff and the other doesn't have a tariff. One would imagine that a technical agreement will be addressing those anomalies.
Yeah, certainly, Oliver. You know what? One of those things about these forums, we have seen it not only with Italy, even with Chinese. So the important thing about it is that we will have different developments as far as progress in those countries, that is. As I told you, that South Africa is a third world country, but with Italy being a first world country that has consumers that are very sensitive to certain issues, those differences will always going to be there. But with South Africa now being a leading supplier of these commodities, it is actually an opportunity for us now when we are to make such agreements with the countries like Italy and others within developed worlds, because that allows us to be able to even stretch ourselves and make sure that we abide by what the countries in the world need, and that is also to align with our production systems, because a lot is happening in terms of what the consumers and the developed countries are needing, and then if that is different to what South Africa sometimes would be producing. So it is one of those issues that is ironing all those differences. Yeah. As you correctly mentioned that example, it is really improving South Africa's capabilities to compete, you know, to the world. It's something that we have done for some decades now.
Yeah, and probably importantly here, how do we ensure that we protect local producers when entering these agreements and arrangements?
That's a very important one, Oliver, and this is something that you know, the Commission at ITEC would normally bring this up. As much as South Africa is you know, punching sometimes above its weight because the third world country, as I mentioned to you, sometimes you tend to not be as efficient in producing certain products with other countries, or also because of the fact that some other countries in the developed world, they tend to be subsidized and get some sort of a support from the state. And in South Africa's actual space, that does not happen. Even if it happens, it is different to those countries that are so well developed. So therefore, it is important for us to make sure whatever that you are doing, we get into it with a careful eye, because sometimes we will want to open up ourselves to a competition that we cannot be to compete with. And that, of course, it goes to the production, the efficiencies, and all of the things that go into a value chain. And, of course, getting to get to be integrated to the world market.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time and your insights on this. Really do appreciate it. Thabile Nkunjana is a senior economist for trade research at the National Agriculture Marketing Council.
And lastly, on South African news, new medicine dispensing courses has been proposed.
Well, let me take you to this now. The South African Pharmacy Council has introduced national minimum standards for dispensing courses aimed at healthcare professionals who are not pharmacists. It intends to allow medical professionals to obtain the necessary licensing to compound and dispense medicines under the Medicines Act. For more on this, we're joined by the CEO of the South African Pharmacy Council, Vincent Tlala. Vincent, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. Why is it necessary to expand the base of medical professionals who are accredited and who are able to dispense pharmacological services such as the dispensing of medicines?
Good evening and good evening to the viewers. Maybe let me start by saying that, one, we are not bringing a new thing. The dispensing by healthcare professionals who are not pharmacists has always been there, and it's in terms of the Medicine and Related Substances Act, Act 101 of 1965. So the course that we just produced, it's mainly to update what is currently there. The first time this course was introduced was in 2003. So we are making an update to the course to ensure that it's relevant and current.
Yeah. So what is being changed here if it's not a new introduction?
It's mainly updated to make sure that, one, it's current in terms of legislation. As you would know, these people are not ordinarily trained to do this work. So as South African Pharmacy Council, we regularly update our legislation, and of importance is good pharmacy practice standards that all people who are doing dispensing are supposed to comply with. And for that matter, I think it's also important to emphasize, because that those people who would be receiving this dispensing license can only dispense medicines that they've prescribed. It does not give them cut-up lines to go and have an open shop and become like a pharmacy. They are limited to dispense their own prescriptions.
Yeah. So currently, the system works in such a way that if a doctor prescribes you medication, you go to a pharmacist, who is able to then take a look at your script and give you even further advice to tell you, well, perhaps do not consider this because it might clash with other medicines that you are currently consuming, and therefore that might be canceling each other out or might cause further complications. Does this course that is now being introduced to fill that gap that you says is a legislative gap to make it up to date, does it cover those sort of complexities that comes with the work of pharmacology?
No, we expect those that have been trained on the dispensing course, one, to be able to know how to store these medicines properly, and to be able to know about interactions. So our expectation is that as they do this work, they should be able to do it in line with the law. And I think maybe also to contextualize this, South Africa does not have all the healthcare professionals it requires. The issue of task shifting and task sharing has been endorsed by World Health Organization. Countries that are developed, such as UK, US, New Zealand, do allow for task shifting. So what we are bringing is nothing new, and it's mainly to ensure that there are places in our country, in the far flung, where there might not be a pharmacy. And indeed, as a patient who goes and see the doctor, who would expect you to receive your medicines. And it's not only for doctors, but also for nurses who are involved with the primary health care services in terms of issuing of medicines. So mainly, for example, in occupational health, those nurses have to do the dispensing course in order for them to issue such medicines.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time and your insights into this, helping us understand this introduction. Really do appreciate it. Vincent Tlala is the CEO of the Saudi African Pharmacy Council.
You know, so microbes could power future farm technology.
At first glance, they look like ordinary mushrooms growing from the ground. But these devices are quietly harvesting electricity from one of nature's smallest workers, bacteria. At a testing site near the University of Bath, researchers are trialing soil-powered batteries designed to generate energy around the clock.
We're currently in our bactery garden, which is one of our field testing facilities outside of Bath. This is where the real science happens. One thing is demonstrating things out in the lab, but we put real emphasis on seeing whether we can replicate what we observe in the lab in the real world.
The technology relies on naturally occurring microbes in the soil. As organisms break down organic matter, they release electrons. Bacteria's system captures that energy and converts it into usable electricity. Engineers say the challenge is making the technology work consistently in different climates and soil conditions.
So we take microbes that are already in the soil, they're living organisms, and we create conditions within the soil and the reactor that allows them to produce electrons, and we take those electrons and we produce that power. And so at the moment, what we do in the lab right here is we develop these fuel cells, these reactors, to work on various different soil types in various places. As you can imagine, outside, the environment is very different.
The company believes the devices could help power low-energy equipment, such as weather stations, where replacing batteries can be costly and difficult.
So this device will be designed to be completely maintenance-free, and we anticipate about a 30-year lifespan for power production. And it's all possible because of the beauty of soil and its capabilities of self-regenerating and sustaining an ecosystem within.
Unlike solar panels, the system can continue producing electricity day and night. And because it sits underground, researchers say it can operate without competing for valuable land space.
I think the most likely scenario of how the world is going to be is you're going to have a lot of good solutions working together as a hybrid on helping us attain those sort of net zero goals and become fully renewable. And that's exactly where I see this technology fitting.
While powering an entire home remains a long-term goal, Bactory says its immediate focus is much smaller, helping connect farms with a steady source of renewable energy generated from the ground up. Ian Kinyua, CGTN.
Ethiopia Airlines holds bookings in Sudanese pounds, demanding US dollar payments.
Let's shift our focus now. Ethiopian Airlines has sparked some outrage in Sudan. That's after it refused to accept Sudanese pounds for ticket bookings in Port Sudan. Now, the airline is demanding cash payments in U.S. dollars only. And, of course, this comes as the Sudanese pound continues its sharp decline against foreign currencies, with the dollar exceeding 4,000 pounds per dollar on the parallel market. Now, travelers are saying the policy is forcing them to buy dollars from the black market, and that's adding a heavy financial burden. Aviation officials and economists have called on authorities to urgently review the airline's policy. Let's find out more about this. Let's head to the ground. Joining us in Port Sudan is Naba Mohideen. Naba, always great to have you with us on the show. Now, let's start off with some insight into why exactly Ethiopia Airlines did this. Why is this decision sparking so much debate in Sudan? And certainly, what kind of impact will this have and has it had on the sector and Sudan's overall economy?
Thanks, Archie. Actually, the debate right now is not about one airline that is not accepting the Sudanese pound, but it's about the confidence in the local currency, which is, of course, is raising concerns for hundreds of thousands of travelers, and also it adds more weight and burden on the Sudanese economy. This, of course, will impact other airlines and aviation sectors that will make the same step, because right now we are facing severe shortages of foreign currency that is, of course, now is increased by the wartime and by the business, because right now the main expenditure in the Sudanese economy is for the war, and also there is a demand, high demand, on the foreign currencies to meet the humanitarian needs, to meet the imports, and to meet the expenditure of the war. So, of course, this will make a very tangible impact on the travelers who are earning their income in the Sudanese pound, and also it will create a high demand on the U.S. dollars, which, of course, will impact the exchange rate even further. So, on the economy, there is a scarcity of foreign exchange. Such steps by foreign companies and airlines and many, many foreign companies, not only aviation sector, will, of course, make more demand on the U.S. dollars and will impact the economy and, of course, the passengers in the first place.
Right, Naba. And as you said, it's all about confidence. And, of course, not just airlines, but companies, foreign companies in general, usually make this move to protect themselves when there's economic instability in the country or, as you said, foreign exchange shortages in the country. What is the current situation in terms of access to foreign currency in Sudan? What is the current state of its foreign exchange markets?
Actually, Ochi, there is a severe shortages of foreign currency, and it's so obvious, and everybody right now is seeing the direct impact of the conflict on the economy. While I'm talking to you right now, in 1 week, foreign currency's exchange rate has declined comparing to the Sudanese pound. The Sudanese pound declined to 21% in 1 week after as a result of many things, our wartime economy, and also as a result of banning some sectors inside the economy, including imports. This created a high demand on the U.S. dollars to meet imports, to meet the humanitarian needs. So generally, there are severe shortages, and people understand that this, of course, this is a direct impact of the wartime economy, and companies are protecting themselves, but in the same time, it creates a scarcity, and it creates more pressure on the Sudanese pound. There is shortages, very obvious shortages, and the demand is increasing every day because the economy right now, there is less economic activities. The economy is weakened by the war, and the expenditure is very high on the war. So, yes, companies are protecting themselves, but it creates more, less confidence in the Sudanese pound and more demand on the U.S. dollars.
And still on that note of companies protecting themselves right now in Sudan, are we seeing more and more foreign companies currently facing any challenges when it comes to repatriating their earnings? Because we know that's one of the major concerns.
Yeah. not only foreign companies, Ochi, actually businesses and individuals right now are protecting themselves and protecting their revenues and their the annual plans of earning. They want assurances that they can transfer those local funds to their headquarters without any restrictions, because we know that Sudan's banking system has been disrupted by the war, and also we are seeing less economic activities and less exports and sabotage of 60% of economic activities. So
Kenya's Apex Bank maintains main leading rate at 8.75%. Let's take a listen to that.
Well, let's move on now to Kenya. The country's Monetary Policy Committee decided to maintain the central bank rate at 8.75%, of course, during its monetary policy meeting this Tuesday. Now, that's despite the conflict in the Middle East disrupting global supply chains and leading to a sharp increase in energy prices and transportation costs in the country. Now, Kenya's overall inflation increased to 6.7% in May from 5.6% in April, and that's on the back of higher energy prices. But we did still see it remain within that target range of 2.5 to 7.5%. Core inflation rose to 3.2% in May from 2.8% in April. Of course, mainly driven by higher fuel prices. Now, processed food inflation remained relatively stable. It was supported by lower prices of sugar and maize products. Non-core inflation increased sharply to 16% in May from 13.4% in April, and that's on account of higher energy prices, particularly fuel and gas prices. Now, economic growth, or GDP, is projected at 4.9% this year. That's compared to the previous projection of 5.3%, of course, reflecting that continued uncertainty. But let's delve into all those numbers now with Teddy Muthoka. He's a research analyst at ArvoCap Asset Managers, and he joins me now in the studio. Great to have you with me in the studio, Teddy.
Thank you.
Now, of course, there was quite a lot of anticipation and discussion around this particular MPC meeting and MPC decision, given the current global realities and, of course, the impact it's had on economies, inflation, blah, blah, blah. What's your take on the decision to hold rates? Did it come as a surprise to the market? And certainly, what was the tone that you sort of got coming out of the MPC's announcement today?
All right. So thank you for having me. I will say that the market was a bit split. You could argue a 50 by 50 probability that there will be a 25 basis point increase or a maintained rate with regards to the central bank rate. And I would also say that from the notice that has been shared, or the briefing that has been shared by the central bank, is that they anticipate that this is a transitory environment, meaning that they expect that the Middle East conflict will taper off really soon, and that they will really not want to hike rates at this particular time, exacerbating what they've been working on for the past previous couple of months.
Mm.
Yes.
And it's interesting that you say it was sort of split.
Yes.
Because we know the Kenya Bankers Association actually came out. They were pushing for further tightening of the central bank rate.
Yes.
And actually what they said, they argued that it will help anchor inflation expectations, support price stability in the medium term. Give us a sense of what experts think about what their argument was.
Yeah. Right. So from the Kenya Bankers Association side, one of the things that they've been primarily looking at is the non-performing loans within the banking sector, and getting to see we've come from 2023 all the way to 2024 and 2025, and getting to see that right now, especially when you look at the bank's results, that being for financial year 2025 and Q and 2026, you will see that there's been a major improvement towards NPLs. But their concern was that if we hike or do not hike at this particular point in time, we are placing ourselves at risk of getting back into a high NPL environment, which will mean lower credit growth and lower credit access to the overall economy.
Mm.
Yes.
And I guess the next question will be to experts. How then do you see this decision to hold rates impacting private sector activity?
Yes.
Impacting credit and lending practices going forward?
All right. So I think one of the things you can give commendation to the CBK is that private sector growth stood in at around 9.9%, if I'm not wrong, of this particular review period, up from I believe around 7% thereabouts. And you could tell that they've really done the work looking at the previous rate cuts that they've done, around 8 of them from last year. But the concern at this particular point in time is, do we want to let go of this number that you've really worked on towards as a central bank when it comes to private sector growth and letting it taper off? So I think right now we'll say it's at a balance where they would want, they are acknowledging, first of all, that, yeah, there are inflationary pressures, effects to the global and local economy as well.
Right.
But we still have leeway to mitigate and maintain and foresee if this situation will worsen further or it will come to an end and what that will mean for the broad economy.
And of course, as you mentioned, the central bank sort of said we're going through a transitionary period.
Yes.
But I want to get more sense of the tone you got, because
yes.
Was it cautiously optimistic? Cautiously optimistic, very optimistic.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get the other side in my head and say it, you know,
yeah.
in a good way. Because they did note, they said there's a need to continue monitoring the evolution of global prices and the second round effects on inflation.
Yes.
They lowered their growth forecast as well, 4.9%
yeah.
from the previous forecast
yes.
of 5.3%. So what's
yes.
your take on the bank's outlook for the economy and the risks ahead?
Definitely cautious. It's plain and simple, and it's cautious. And even when you compare with some of our neighbors, like South Africa recently hiked theirs by 25 basis points as well. And so when it comes to the local economy, even when you look at the press briefing, you will see the need to anchor or support their decision by factors such as the FX reserve situation, where we have around 13.2 billion translating to 5.6 months of import cover. Also getting to look at stable food prices due to a general healthy weather environment, if I may put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll say that it's very cautious, that we do not want to push it further on as we'll want to, but the risks are evident across the board, which is also justified by the numbers that they've shared. Inflation ticking upwards towards the 7.5 range, looking at lower GDP estimates as well, and also other pressures which are also coming about, such as domestic borrowing being 85% of the total debt situation in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so noting that if we hike at this particular point, there's much liquidity in the market, and what investors will push towards is higher yields on domestic borrowing, which is 85% of the nation's debt capacity, will really worsen things in the mid to long term.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, before we leave you, Teddy, quickly, I wanted to find out what...
Okay, now we'll be cutting into Onko Nanadingi's time. So let's pause here now for hand over to the Onko Nanadingi program. And for me, Ndafa, happy Juju, it is goodbye. Please have yourself a wonderful afternoon, a wonderful Thursday afternoon. I'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place.